Welcome to Beyond Beauty, where we uncover the remarkable stories behind the extraordinary women artists in the world of art and culture. I'm Jacqueline Cofield, your host. Join us as we explore the diverse landscapes of artistic expression, shining a light on the voices that often go unheard and the perspectives that redefine beauty and knowledge. From Nigeria to Brazil, from India to Jamaica, we celebrate the rich tapestry of creativity that transcends borders and challenges conventions. Through insightful conversations and captivating narratives, we invite you to immerse yourself in the stories of courageous women who dare to dream, create, and inspire. I'm absolutely delighted to have you join us for today's conversation with Edra Soto, a multidisciplinary artist whose work transcends boundaries, weaving together themes of culture, identity, and community with captivating creativity and insight. From her installations to her thought-provoking curatorial endeavors, Edra's impact resonates far and wide, challenging perceptions and sparking meaningful dialogue. So, without further ado, let's dive into this enriching dialogue with the brilliant Edra Soto. Edra, I'm so excited to talk to you today. Thank you so much for your time and for meeting with me. And I know you've been traveling and you just arrived in New York. So I'm just very, very excited. I first became exposed to your work as a museum educator at the Whitney Museum. And I've been talking about your work and interacting with it. And I just love it. And so I'm so excited to be able to talk with you today. I'll actually be talking on Sunday about it in Spanish and in English. So this will be really helpful.
We can definitely do the Spanglish.
That's definitely what I do. My Spanish is definitely Spanglish. And I'm like, at least if people can understand me, that's all that counts. So you are, in my opinion, a serious researcher. Tell me about your graduate studies at the Art Institute of Chicago. What was the focus of your research? Where did you do it and why?
Well, first, thank you, Jacqueline, for having me in your program. I'm so excited to engage in conversation with you. Well, when I attended the School of the Art Institute, I realized soon enough that perhaps I didn't have the education or the preparation to navigate things easily. I come from Puerto Rico. I did all my education at a Catholic elementary and high school. And then I went to, or I attended Escuela de Artes Plásticas de Puerto Rico. That is a school of design of Puerto Rico in Old San Juan. That is the only school that provides an BFA degree. And it was very much studio-based, and I had history courses. I think during that time, I realized that I was interested in content and how to expand on narratives through content. And I have memories about having a professor giving an assignment and maybe me being the only one that brought the assignment that required writing for a xylography class. And I kept thinking, I've always been interested in writing and creative writing. I joined a poetry course, and I don't think I was very good. Many things that I started making that school that I think I got indication that I was not good at it. And I didn't really had a great foundation, but I always felt very much creative and in need of an outlet. And so, well, years pass, I go to the Art Institute, and this experience is telling me I'm not going to make the cut here if I don't apply myself or look for help, because I really didn't have a great foundation to start with, you know, and to expand on conceptual work the way that I wanted to. So I think being very honest and admitting to myself, you know, I'm not a scholar. This is not the level that I that I am, but I love education. I became a teacher and I taught high school for inner city kids. I taught high school for 10 years and that was a great experience. I taught just basic art courses.
Was that in Chicago that you were teaching high school?
Yes, at the Chicago Public Schools for 3 years and 6 years for the Chicago Charter Schools.
And that was while you were studying at the Art Institute, or that was before?
That was soon after. Ah. That was my first job, was teaching for a program called After School Matters that provides jobs for young artists and place them in high schools. And that was my first teaching experience. And I really loved it. I love working with high school kids. I was a very shy person. I think I recur to art to express myself. And that's exactly why I'm an artist, because I needed a voice and I couldn't do that for myself. I was extremely shy. I grew up in a sheltered kind of environment that didn't really support that as well.
You said that you were shy. So do you think that, or are you suggesting that your experience as a high school teacher helped you to overcome that shyness?
Yeah, I think at that point in my life, I overcome some of the fear. I didn't have the confidence to teach at the university level. That happened years after at the School of the Art Institute. I also taught at UIC. And those were great experiences as well. I think I spent 7 years teaching to undergrads and then advising grad students. That has been the best time in the later part of my teaching career.
You know, but I also was a teacher and I also sort of identified myself before as shy. I taught sixth grade science. And I tell people that I feel, because like as a teacher, you're doing public speaking every single day. And when you're teaching like young people, that is really complicated and exciting. And they will really like grow you up as a speaker. And I really do feel like that teaching helped to eradicate my fear of public speaking. So I'm really interested that you said that. But I kind of want to rewind for a second. So you're in Puerto Rico, you're studying at the Catholic school and the art school in Old San Juan. So what brought you to Chicago then? How did that happen?
The School of the Art Institute. I became a commercial painter in Puerto Rico. And that led me to be in this commercial gallery for a while. That through that gallery, I found great success as a commercial painter. But I didn't really know much about the art world, about the commercial art world, or the art world. It just, my life had nothing to do with that world. And the kinds of paintings that I made were perhaps somewhat naive, but they really allowed me to express myself. So I think maybe the part of it that was authentic, it was appreciated. And then the galleries felt like that they had this cultural value that made them, you know, a part of the beginning of my career. But these galleries, her name is Maud Dukela. And today she's 86 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I got to reconnect with her. And she became my friend. I love her very much. I think she's a luminary, you know, like a very knowledgeable woman from Haiti that migrated to Puerto Rico and made an incredible career there as a dealer. And she was the dealer of some very important artists in Puerto Rico, like Arnaldo Roche, which at the time she was representing him. And I mention this because when I was a part of the gallery, she told me, if you are going to do your MFA, you should go to the School of the Art Institute. And I think she recommended it mainly because Arnaldo Roche went to the school and he found great success and acceptance there. Wow. And So that was very much what influenced my decision of coming to Chicago, going to Chicago and doing my master's.
And was that the only school that you applied to?
I think so.
That's
Yeah.
amazing. And you're still in Chicago, so you must love Chicago now.
I love Chicago for many, many things. They have great cultural activity, and it's also easy to navigate, to get around,
Yeah.
because they have the train, they have buses, and I have a car, but I have some limitations, so I cannot drive, on the highway or some places. And,
Do you
but I,
escape? Do you
so,
escape the cold weather in the winter? How do you deal with that?
well, I travel many, many times to Puerto Rico because I still have my mother and my brother there, and that really pulled me. I've been in a back and forth for a very long time, and now more. But I'm in hold because I have a lot of work right now with my art career, and so I'm looking forward to visiting, probably like in mid-May or June.
Okay, so back to you as a researcher. So,
Yes.
I want to learn more about your graduate studies research that you did, because I looked that up and I thought it was so interesting.
Well, I actually think it was not during my graduate years, but it was after, because the project graph, I've been pursuing this project for over a decade now, but it happened a bit after grad school. I've been out of school over 20 years. So I think that what I did in grad school, I started to make work outside of my concentration, that was painting. And I think I became very much a multidisciplinary artist. I created my own project space. So the research really comes after grad school. I figure how to integrate the research aspect in my work without disrupting the visual art experience. So it was very, I don't know, I just had really, I think I had really clear goals of what I wanted to do. I thought after graduating from SAIC, I thought there's no room for, making naive work or work that is not informed. I won't really progress. So I have to apply myself. But I also felt very compelled to learning because of the subjects that I was interested in. So the research that really take place for the project graph is trying to learn and understand about the decorative concrete fences and decorative motifs and the raw iron fence motifs that live in Puerto Rico in the lower and middle class communities. That is the beginning of my research.
And so the piece graph that's at the Whitney now in the show No Existe un Mundo Pusurikan, is that one of the first pieces that you were working on? And that is that a series or just this idea of graph? Like, is it a series of works? Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so graph is architectural intervention, and as such, I have to consider the space where it's going to live. The iteration of graph that is at the Whitney Museum, I'm not sure what number it is, but it might be like 13, 14. I've been working on graph for over 10 years now. But this is the first iteration that I make of graft that is made creating a representation of a decorative concrete motif. So I never have done decorative concrete motif. And this is the first time I have the access to the technology that allow me to craft, a concrete block to make it look like a concrete block, or at least the motif in a more three-dimensional form.
So
So,
you're creating those, or are some of them also found objects that you're working with as well?
no, they are sources, that comes from Puerto Rico. And the project is titled Graft because it's a symbolic type of transplant. I am grafting something from Puerto Rico and placing it in anywhere in the United States. And I think about it as a way of inhabiting a space.
And what role does color play? Because I noticed that there was different, the one that's at the Whitney is red, and I've seen white, I've seen black, I think. Can you talk about the role of color in the Graft series?
Yeah, well, everything that is made through the Project Graft have a source. So the original source of that particular piece that is at the Whitney, the original one is in color red. But there's other, this is a decorative concrete block that is very common in Puerto Rico, but it's not very commonly made commercially produced. It's not commonly produced commercially. So I became more interested in this particular decorative motif because it's very strange. I don't find it particularly beautiful, but it's intriguing. And you have this, it's very, I don't know, I find that kind of unforgettable. You have this characteristic, it kind of look like a flower, but it also can look like, I don't know, some people have compared it, like, if is it a graphic coming from, like, the hurricane? I'm like, no, it's it's a decorative concrete block. But I'm glad that people have all kinds of reading.
Yes, people have asked me the decorative nature of the piece Graft that's at the Whitney. They've asked me about, are there African influences in the design of the piece? And so I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yes. So through the research that I did that motivated me to continue to do the Project Graft, I found a monograph by a Puerto Rican architect. And his name is Jorge Ortiz Colom. And he wrote about the African influence in the design build of Puerto Rico. And this, you know, in his research, he advocates for this African influence, which is something that is not part of the populous knowledge of Puerto Rico. And as a high school teacher, or an ex-high school teacher, mm-hmm. I kept thinking about how fascinating it is when you find things that, in this case, I thought this should be a part of the common knowledge. These are the houses of the lower and middle class homes. And these particular elements have been appropriated for centuries. So, you know, it was a motivation to start the project. And as I say, I'm so intrigued about information, and I'm interested in learning. So I thought I really cannot do this project by myself, because I thought it was too important to kind of limit it to my own views about it. So I decided to invite other architects, historians, even other artists, poets. I have a great archive that I've been building throughout the years of contributions, literary contributions and art contributions that are a part of the archive of Graft, that not only speak about that African influence, but in general about the experience of the project and what the project is intending.
One of the things I love about it is that it really invites the viewer to, like, they have to work in order to engage the piece. Like, they have to move their body. There's, like, this embodied nature. And it's interesting because that piece at the Whitney is up against the wall. But when I think about how I read about how you talk about how architecture is mediating social relations, I think, you know, it's interesting. It would be also, I would love to experience the work not against the wall, where we could, like, go on other sides. And I've seen pictures. I know that it's often displayed that way as well. So yeah, I've just been there's counted people having actually emotional reactions as well. There's a woman who was from Puerto Rico, and she she was like, oh, you know, those things she was like, I have a hard time to look at those because I think it was bringing a lot of memories back for her. And I was like, wow, that's, tell me more about that. So it's been a true pleasure to continue to interact with that piece.
It's so nostalgic for so many people. I get a lot of anecdotes from, you know, from viewers, people that I don't know that will share a picture, will write to me and tell me about it. It's been so powerful, you know, and satisfying also to do this project.
I've seen images of Rejas in museums and homes and outdoors as public art. Do you have a preference for where these works belong or speak most profoundly?
Yeah, well, each place kind of gives me something. So the thing about craft that I enjoy the most is that it's almost like crafting a gift for somebody. And in the case of the experience of how to make craft, I have to go to the site and really try to absorb every part of the site, the architecture, the history around it, the light, the colors, everything, you know, that could possibly give me an indication of what would be the best way to respond to it. So I see graph as a series of responses to the site. But I don't know if I have a favorite. I had, you know, I have made some graph iteration that have been amazing to see them, like one that was a temporary commission at the Chicago Botanic Gardens. And this was a representation of a house that was inspired by one of these concrete homes that live in Puerto Rico. This representation was fenced with a particular decorative pattern that also I source, like everything else, I source from these neighborhoods in Puerto Rico. And then that iteration lived on a lagoon. So the site, imagine this absolutely breathtaking lagoon in a botanic garden. And your work is going to be floating there.
Oh, wow.
For months. So that was amazing to be able to choose that site and then to craft something for that site was a bit challenging because I have to use my imagination really to address this because the structure was not going to be close to the public. It was going to, you know, I think it was 30 or 40 feet away from viewer. Mm-hmm. So you can see it through the distance. And the original design didn't have a color. It was white. And I was not 100% happy with that because it was just a solution that I felt like I had to settle with till I found the right solution. And as I am visiting and revisiting this site at the Botanic Gardens, I realized I started absorbing the color from this place. And I put in my mind, I put a palette of colors together. And it was tones of blues and tones of green and brick, concrete colors. And the palette itself, I decided that I was going to use these colors to paint the surface of graft. And I never have painted the surface in an organic manner. Mm. So before the work at the Whitney Museum, this is the first iteration of graft that I paint in a very loose form on top of these structures and decorative patterns. So it was a pretty large sculpture. It was over 50 feet wide.
Oh, wow. And
like 14 feet tall. And I got the colors that I selected. They were like four colors and I diluted them. They were house paint that I diluted with water and I got some rollers and painted with others as well. I had friends helping me paint this very large like lattice walls in this very organic way. So there was the element of chance and how that was going to look like from a distance. So there were a lot of series of chances that I had to take, you know, to make it happen. I couldn't really imagine. There was not also like a chance for trying it out.
Right. I love that you had people helping you, like collaborating with you. That sounds like a wonderful experience, like a paint party with Edra Soto.
It was a paint party.
I was imagining it.
I haven't done many paint parties. That's a very rare, moment in my life. And my in-laws were there painting with me.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah. I would love to see photos of that.
Yeah. I think there's some pictures on their website, on the Chicago Botanic Garden website.
Okay, awesome. Great.
Yeah.
So reflect on your schooling experiences throughout your life, from childhood through graduate school. Do any of these experiences stand out in particular as influential to your journey in becoming an artist or your practice as an artist? How did Edra Soto arrive at being an artist?
Yeah, I think I attribute my formation to my years in Puerto Rico. When I was in high school, I think that's when I became more comfortable expressing myself through art. During my upbringing in Puerto Rico, at my home, there was a lot of crafting. Like my parents, they used to have a commercial ceramic business. So they will make ceramics at home. They will make molds, and everything was like, imagine commercial ceramics are like pre-made molds that are casted with slip, and you know, they're like figurines and things that are just commercially available. And then they casted other things themselves, and then they will make handmade objects and things like that. There was a lot of casting. They love casting and like putting them on the kiln. And I love the experience of making, you know, crafty things. I remember making these pendants that I would put little rocks, and the rocks were like a type of glaze that when you put it in the kiln and you take it out, you don't know the color. You will know the color when they come out of the kiln. So I love that. That was really fun to do that. And then I will sell them like necklaces with this little pendant that I made. And my mother was also, she had her cake business at home. But they were not like just birthday cakes, you know. She will make installations of wedding cakes and quinceañera cakes. It will be a production of like this mirror with sugar lakes and bridges and skirts and sugar flowers. And it was just amazing, you know. And I think that probably influenced me some in my desire to like make art. But in high school, I ended up having an art club, and I was the president of the art club. And then I will like engage others into like, and being enthusiastic about drawing, and I will make drawings for the theater club. They will have events, and I will make up, you know, an illustration for that, or for graduation, for little programs. And I made a mural for the volleyball tournament. So wow. That was high school. And then in college, having this success in the commercial sector gave my parents confidence, you know, to support me. So I think if it was not for that experience, it was immediately after, or like during my last year of as an undergrad, I was taken by this gallery and I had a painting career that lead me to live in Paris. I live in Paris for 1 year. That was the first time I left Puerto Rico. That was a fellowship for Puerto Rican painters. And that was the first time I left. I came back to Puerto Rico. I taught drawing class at the school that I graduated, the undergrad school, I think for a summer or so. And I applied to the School of the Art Institute. And I actually didn't get in the MFA program right away. I got into a program called the Post-Baccalaureate. And I joined that program for a year. And I loved it. I loved the school. It was really hard for me. I thought I knew English till I got there. Now I know my English is terrible. And, I felt enthusiastic about the prospect of becoming an artist. It was not something that existed in my family, around my family, and also end up being the first one having a master's degree in my family. So just things that were not, I didn't expect them to happen, but art kind of make me a whole person.
I love this, how you were a young, where you were a child and you were experimenting in the kiln, you know, like, I mean, I can only imagine how stimulating that must have been. I mean, I imagine it was also a very large one as well, if it's a commercial.
Yeah. You live in the backyard of our home. And there's a display in the garage of my home in Puerto Rico that still have many of these figures. I took a picture of it recently and I told my brother, please never get rid of this. This is kind of amazing that there's a whole closet full of these figurines.
Yes.
That make no sense, you know, like, yes, where they come from. Well, you know, there's all kinds of, you can travel the world through these figurines, you know, they're kind of amazing. And also, I don't know, consider junk, you know, as well, you know, but it's fascinating. And many of them are not even, they were not put through the kiln. So they are not, how do you say, I forgot the term, but they are not complete, you know?
Oh, wow. And here you are all these years later, still experimenting. Yes, I love it. Okay. So I'm really interested in your international experiences. You know, you've mentioned that you studied in Paris or France, and then of course you studied in the US, being from Puerto Rico. And then also you were part of the MacArthur Foundation's International Connections. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the role that global travel has played in your artistic development?
Yes, I think every time I travel, it's such a fulfilling moment because it really opens up a new door. It really kind of allowed me to expand my connection to the projects that I'm doing. And in the case of Graft, you know, that this project is the one that like brought me to the MacArthur grants and the experience in Cuba and seeing the Quiebrasoles there. It's very different than what I actually imagined because they're way more prominent in Puerto Rico. But the experience in Brazil, you know, in Salvador, it was very fulfilling because there's a lot of this domestic architecture in Brazil as well. So, these motifs are all over the world. And I do focus on the ones that live in Puerto Rico to call for the African influence. But the traveling itself, it really have allowed me to also grow as a person. I just felt that I never imagined my life outside of Puerto Rico when I was in high school. And I don't think I imagine myself living the rest of my life in Puerto Rico. I need to go to Puerto Rico. And I will always go to Puerto Rico. And I live in Puerto Rico more than anywhere else. I still haven't lived more in Chicago than in Puerto Rico. I lived 27 years of my life there. So that's the great thing about having all these experiences and moving back and forth, is that it also have allowed me to see Puerto Rico in a very different lens and also put myself in the position of somebody that don't know Puerto Rico. It's like rediscovering my island. And I think all of that is really contained in this project. The archives that are embedded in the viewfinders, where you can see the little pictures, are very organic as well. Like there's pictures that I took 10 years ago, and there's pictures that I took yesterday, and I will put them together. So I really don't follow any rules about editions and organizing. I think the archives and memories are things that are very organic in your life. And when you start building a narrative, sometimes you need something from the past to connect with something that you will discover in your present to be able to tell the story.
Wow. Okay. Yes, absolutely. I want to like snap my fingers at that. I'm going to go back and like copy that sentence down and make that like one of the features. As it's just, you know, I have learned so much about the relations between U.S. and Puerto Rico through this exhibition at the Whitney. I'm so grateful to be, you know, there at this time and have been like so intimate, you know, with that show, and with your work. And, I mean, now it's like, I'm looking at it, you know, I look at the relations completely different, and I've been there before. And now I want to go back, you know, with what I know now, because I had, you know, like I did not. And I think, you know, as you're probably kind of sort of what you're alluding to, a lot of people in the U.S. don't know these things, you know. And I think that's the brilliance about art, is, you know, is just the way that it teaches us, and also you artists, you know. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing the type of research and studies that I do, looking at artists as teachers and looking at art as teaching. So you are a multidisciplinary artist and now even a curator. What feelings, ideas, events are important to your artistic practices and your curatorial choices?
Yeah, that's a great question. I usually, when I organize exhibitions that I have in the past, they are somewhat weaved with the kinds of work that I'm doing at the time, because I think I'm seeking for expanding my own personal knowledge about what I'm doing. Sometimes I can make something that comes from a gut feeling, truly. Just like I really like to obey my, you know, like my intuition when I'm making art. And I let that sometimes simmer and be like, I will understand it fully. And sometimes it will take me a while, but I have to let it exist, because I think when something, you know, like, that comes maybe from my imagination and from life knowledge, you know, things take shape and form. And I sometimes feel like, well, I think I have to really let it out. It's like I'm like being a vessel that is like kind of like shooting, transforming, you know, and all these representations, I think they have something to do with that manifesting. Yeah.
Yeah. What brought you to curating? I always think it's so interesting when artists are curating, or, you know, just different people curating. And so this idea of like thinking about who is a curator, who can be a curator, you know, and I think it's so interesting. There's so many artists also curating. So what brought you to curating?
Yeah, well, it made a lot of sense at some point. I think I started curating in a very intuitive way. I love art so much. I really am an admirer of art. I'm fascinated by other artists and their work. So I like learning about other artists and what are their motivations. And when I was a student at the School of the Art Institute, I had access to viewing the studios at any time. I can just like maybe knock the door or like look through a curtain and see what's happening. And in my mind, I will build these installations with other people's work. And I did have the opportunity to curate the first exhibition that I ever curated. It was titled Glam Salon. And it was like take on a beauty salon with all these artifacts that were made by different female identified artists, like a chandelier made with these test tubes. There was this like pictures of imprints of kisses. There were these wigs that were made with rice and different raw materials that were like food. Like there was a wig made with chicken wings. Yeah. And so all the very like crazy, powerful work. There was a performance artist bathing in a hammock with fruit. So it was just nuts, you know? But yeah, that was my first time. And I really didn't understand much the concept of curation or that role in art. It's not something that I was not taught about this in college. I learned that at the Art Institute, you know? And after grad school, I think maybe a year or so after grad school, I learned about the artist-run community in Chicago. And that was so inspiring. Like I was fascinated by, you know, all these relationships that artists, supporting artists. And through that relationship, many things happened, including creating my project space that is titled The Franklin, because I live in Franklin Boulevard, and it's kind of like a gazebo type of project space. It's outdoors, but it's like a house that have a ceiling and it have six walls that are removable. And the first time I made The Franklin, it was in collaboration with my husband, and we built part of the structure of the Franklin and we place it in a gallery. And inside the gallery, we show part of our collection, art collection. And the collection that we have is because we both love art and we have bought some art through the years, but also the collection is, you know, the consequence of my relationship with artists that I have met throughout the years and trading work with artists. So that's one part of the collection. The other part is things that we have purchased at nonprofit organizations and artist run spaces or at auctions for nonprofit artist run spaces and gifts. There's a lot of art that have been gifted to us because artists know that we put the work on the walls and we talk about them. So I don't know. There's a lot of kind of
the synergies. Of yeah.
Celebration, the energy that is really unique. And yeah, I think that influenced my, just my, you know, my desire for putting work together of different artists. And sometimes I think of it as making an installation with other people's work. But curation is so, you know, way more complicated than that. But that's how I usually start, you know, when I have an idea for an exhibition. And, you know, sometimes thematic exhibitions and things that allow me to learn about a particular subject.
Right, right. I love that, how you're thinking about your relationships and your excitement. It's almost like that idea about the art party is coming back, you know, like curating is sort of like, you know, this opportunity to bring all these artists together. So maybe our last question. As a woman artist, what advice would you give to other women artists coming up?
I will say support other female artists. I think that is so important because it has to be a conscious decision, you know, like you have to be very purposeful about it. And sometimes, you know, in this art, the ecosystem of the art world, there's so many females on leading positions that are not enough supportive to other female artists. And that could be disappointing, you know? So that would be my main advice. support one another.
Yes, I love it. And thank you for supporting me and being part of this conversation.
Thank you for your patience as well.
I'm patient. You know, I'll definitely be patient. I'll be persistent. And I'm just so, you know, I'm so, so grateful more than anything else. And thank you.
Likewise.
So much.
Likewise. Thank you. I'm so grateful for your invitation and for connecting with you. You're so kind.
Yes. And I think we're going to be dancing.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I'm ready.
Yes, our party continues.
Yes, let it happen.
Yay. I mentioned rejas, and I just want to point out that that is the Spanish word for fences. As we conclude this enlightening conversation here on Beyond Beauty, I extend my heartfelt gratitude to the incomparable Edra Soto for her time, wisdom, and passion. Through her artistry and advocacy, Edra exemplifies the transformative power of creativity and the importance of embracing one's unique voice. Thank you for joining us on this enlightening expedition through the world of women artists from the Global South and its diasporas. We hope you've been inspired by the stories shared and perspectives explored. Remember, beauty knows no bounds and creativity thrives in every corner of the globe. Keep seeking out the voices that challenge, uplift, and redefine our understanding of art and culture. Until next time, stay curious, stay open-minded, and continue to explore the beauty that lies beyond beauty.